Yes.
What do you mean with before? When before?
The subject that has been on my mind to discuss or bring up today is has to do with saying no to things, the denial, rejection, saying no. And it's a huge subject, so I'm not going to try to be comprehensive in it. Just kind of talk about some of the things that's happening in, for me and my thoughts around it and my practice around it. And partly the inspiration for this came out of this year I've sat two retreats on my own rather than teaching them and sitting them as a student. And even after all these years of practice, I was surprised to see that how subtle the mind is. It shouldn't have been a surprise. The mind is very, very subtle, the tricks of the mind. And to see the subtlety in which my mind was still saying no to things, kind of rejecting things, saying, that I shouldn't be there. That's not what I should be experiencing right now. There's something better to be experiencing. I'm really supposed to be with my breath, not with, you know, my knee pain or whatever, and not with my, you know, feeling of whatever my feelings were at the moment. And so there was often I noticed a very subtle kind of a subtle aversion or rejection of some particular thing, kind of saying no to that, and then turning to something else which I thought was better or the right thing to do. And in the way mindfulness works, in when mindfulness is somewhat mature, is it's mindfulness is really sitting ourselves in the middle of our life as it is and experiencing our life in the middle of it as it is without any moving away or moving towards anything, but rather experiencing what's happening in the middle of our life. So part of what Buddhism is about is a relief to suffering. And in the tradition, it says that there are four primary causes and suffering arises because of craving or clinging to things. And there are four primary clingings or cravings that we might be engaged in. And the four are clinging to pleasure, clinging to our views and opinions. And then the last two are particularly interesting. Clinging, a craving for existence. And the fourth is craving for non-existence. So both of them are suffering producing. Both of them are considered to be causes of suffering. To want to have existence is to have suffering. And to want to have non-existence is to create more suffering. Both of them are paths leading to suffering. And the first one, craving for existence, is one that maybe many Americans, you know, would rather overlook, because there's a tremendous life-affirming kind of tendency in American culture. And what's wrong with existence? What's wrong with wanting to be alive or wanting to exist or wanting anything to exist? And the second is something which most people don't particularly, at least in its gross forms, don't particularly usually get involved in too much, the desire for non-existence, though it occurs to most people maybe some point in their life when life gets difficult. And the Buddhist tradition is saying there's an alternative. You don't have to have a desire for either existence or non-existence. You can just simply be alive. Or more appropriately, you can be mindful in a situation rather than wanting it to exist or want more of it or to create something different or to want it to not exist or to get rid of it or reject it or keep it at a distance. The alternative to both things is to sit in the midst of what's happening wakefully, with awareness, with mindfulness. This is what's going on. And even though Buddhism is designed as a relief for suffering, some people will like to argue or make the point that Buddhist practice is not therapy. It's not necessarily making a healthier ego or healthier kind of sense of self, or not necessarily kind of adjusting all the neuroses we have, so we have designer psyches. And if we, you know, it's kind of like, you know, there are fads in psyches. Just like there's fads in body types and fads in dresses and clothes. And so there's fads in psyches. And, you know, you can kind of track through this. The fads happen faster as we get into the 20th century. But you can adjust your psyche, you know, design your psyche. And so people go to therapy, and often for very good reasons. But sometimes therapy is more just adjusting the psyche. And so some people say Buddhism isn't so much about that kind of therapy. Buddhism is not necessarily offering to make your psychic life, your mental life, healthier. So that maybe it's kind of doesn't sound so nice, does it? Mm-hmm. It's bad news. Mm-hmm. But rather, what Buddhism does, my understanding, is that it helps us become more conscious of our life, which often what therapy does, anyways. But the function of Buddhism is to make ourselves more and more conscious of life, rather than simply adjusting the furniture of our psyche. And what happens as we become more conscious of more conscious of life, more conscious of ourselves, then I think we naturally kind of accord with better with the way things are. And as we accord with the way things are and don't resist things as much or don't push things away as much, then I think the byproduct of that is, in fact, a relief from suffering or kind of a healthier mental framework or mental mind. So, you know, in the end, there's definitely relief through Buddhist practice. But I stress this point because some people do Buddhist practice too much with a goal of therapy, to try to get relief from their life. And in the result of trying to get relief from their life, are often running away from things or trying to push things away or not really trying to be there fully for that experience. I had an interview recently with a young man who encountered Buddhism at a time when he was suffering really terribly. He'd ended a relationship that was very painful to end. He was grieving it, and his friends weren't around for him anymore to kind of support him in the way he felt he needed support. He was traveling around the world and was kind of quite lonely, and he described himself as reaching rock bottom. And he would happen to be in Kathmandu. And so what you do in Kathmandu? Well, you go to Kopan Monastery, which is this Tibetan monastery that welcomes a lot of Westerners. And they kept talking about suffering. And it was such a relief to him because he was suffering. And here was someone talking about it, and he didn't feel like it was such a... just the fact that people were willing to talk about it, and the fact that it was kind of accepted as part of life, they were suffering, he felt all this relief. It was very helpful for him. And then a sad thing happened. He adopted the Buddhist ideal of some ideal of perfection, that he could become perfectly free of all suffering as what he had to do in order to be a successful human being. And at that, when he did that, then he lost the benefits he had gotten from Buddhism. Because he was no longer just kind of just accepting his life as it was, and then accepting mindfulness of it, negotiating his way the best he could. This particular person, he was constantly then rejecting himself, chasing after some kind of ideal of what he thought was a good meditator supposed to experience. So he thought a good meditator is supposed to be concentrated, and sometimes he could get concentrated, and concentration is kind of pleasant. And it's different than his normal kind of neurotic mind. So the few times he got concentrated, he said, "Aha, I got it. I have to." And whenever he lost his concentration, he felt despair. And when you feel despair, it's very hard to get concentrated again. Or he would come on retreats and he said, "Well, I have to get concentrated again because only then will I have proof that I'm making any success in my practice." And then because he was striving so hard, it interfered with any attempts to get concentrated. In the meantime, all the feelings of being of not liking himself, of feeling like a failure, of feeling that of having a scattered mind, of having worries and anxieties. All those things he said no to, in the sense of not wanting to pay attention to them. For him, they were examples of failure in practice, failures to attain the ideal. And so he kept saying, no, I'm not going to pay attention to that. I'm going to push that away, and I'm going to bring my mind back and try to focus on the breath and get concentrated. And sometimes the attempt to come back to the breath can be done as a rejection of something we don't want. And this is what surprised me in my recent retreat, that I was still doing that. It was very, very subtle, but I was still doing that. You know, something would occur and I would kind of suddenly, well, you know, not that. Not now, not today. just go back to the breath so I can get, you know, concentrated or whatever. So the many ways we say no to things. And the sad thing, especially with the example of this friend of mine, is that he was losing himself in the process. He was becoming increasingly estranged from himself by fixating on a goal and rejecting who he actually was, or rejecting what his actual experience was in the moment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of burying himself in a grave of denial, rejection, and striving. And there are so many ways, I think, that we say no to experience. And sometimes we simply reject it as being valid, or reject it as being, this is not really the point of life, or Buddhist life, or mindfulness practice, or, one of the shadows of Buddhist practitioners is anger. You know, Buddhists are supposed to be kind people. And as soon as you have this tradition where you're supposed to be anyway, then the way you're not supposed to be often gets rejected, causing all kinds of problems. So sometimes Buddhist practitioners will say, well, anger will arise, and they say, oh, not that. You know, they don't look at it. They don't bring their attention. They don't bring consciousness to it. And whenever you don't bring consciousness to it, then it begins to usually have an unhealthy life. It kind of does odd things. There's a wonderful poem about this by Kabir. A friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day that the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it holds on to one thing. Kabir says, listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path. And we know, we have the example of many religious people, many religions of religious people who take the path of denial or rejecting things. It seems that almost as if spiritual people, often enter spiritual life because they have some difficulty with something. They have difficulties with whatever, relationships, with sexuality, with work, with money, with family, themselves. And so one of the tendencies then is the things that we have trouble with is sometimes say, well, a pure spiritual life is a life that doesn't have those things. So it doesn't have sexuality, it doesn't have relationships, it doesn't have family, it doesn't have money, it doesn't have a home, it doesn't have a self. Right? In Buddhism, sometimes people say that. So, and you probably have heard this before, that there's a very strong tendency in religious traditions to reject all those things and to look towards the people who don't have anything to do with those as being the saints. People who are kind of ascetics or living completely pure, free lives. And I don't want to say that, I don't want to reject that ideal or reject that as something that maybe that's appropriate for some people. But it can be another example of turning away and saying no to some part of ourselves, and then picking up a religious tradition that holds up an ideal of purity to affirm for us or support for us our tendency to reject something we're uncomfortable with. This rejecting of what we're uncomfortable with is to become unconscious. And Buddhism is about becoming conscious in the midst of our life, not turning away from anything. So a poem from Rumi. Rumi probably got this idea from Socrates. And Socrates wrote, "Pain and pleasure are never present to a person at the same instant. And yet, the person who pursues either is compelled to take the other." Pain and pleasure are never present to a person at the same instant. And yet, the person who pursues either is compelled to take the other. If you're pursuing pleasure, then you're compelled to feel some pain. If you're pursuing pain, maybe you'll feel pleasure. So this is what Rumi says. One dervish said to another, "What was your vision of God's presence?" "I haven't seen anything, but for the sake of conversation, I'll tell you a story." "God's presence is there in front of me, a fire on the left, a lovely stream on the right. One group walks towards the fire, into the fire, another toward the sweet flowing water. No one knows which are blessed and which not. Whoever walks into the fire appears suddenly in the stream. A head goes under on the water surface, that head pokes out of the fire. Most people guard against going into the fire and so end up in it. Those who love the water of pleasure and make it their devotion are cheated with this reversal. The trickery goes further. The voice of the fire tells the truth, saying, 'I am not fire. I am fountainhead. Come into me and don't mind the sparks.'" So actually, in Buddhist practice, we don't have to go into the fire. And we don't have to go into the stream. All we have to do is sit in the middle of what comes to us. And sometimes the fire comes to us. Haven't you noticed? Sometimes you're sitting there and suddenly, wow, where did that come from? Or you're minding your own business at work and suddenly, Jesus, suddenly your work becomes hell suddenly all around you. You're just minding your business. And the fire arrived. You know, sooner or later, fire will arrive, or sooner or later, this wonderful, cool pleasure will arise. And Buddhist practice is not to go looking for them particularly, but when they arrive, to sit in the middle of them, which is kind of a metaphorical way Buddhists have of speaking, because we sit a lot. Sitting in the middle of things means to enter consciously into the experience, to really feel it and be there fully for it, being very sensitive to the movement, our movements, to reject it, to say no to it, or to hold on to it or to want more of it. And to see if it's possible to have eaten neither. And in having neither, to fully experience our life consciously. And in doing that, to experiencing it deeply. I think many of us who are looking for solutions for our life, you know, we feel there's a lot of suffering or a lot of anxiety or neurosis or whatever we might have. And we often spin around the surface of the mind on the problems and the sufferings and the issues. And I don't know if there are always solutions to our life problems. People come to Buddhism sometimes looking for all kinds of solutions. But I don't know if there's always a solution to everything, all the difficulties in our life. But however, to experience our life deeply, to experience it fully consciously, is a kind of solution. When we experience our life shallowly on the surface, and we kind of run away from our fears, or you know, running after pleasure and all that, and it becomes kind of a treadmill of many activities, we don't really experience a depth the mystery of who we are as a human being. I think that to be a human being, to be alive, is a phenomenal mystery. And now that I have a young boy who's now 7.5 months old, I think it's more of a mystery than I ever realized. And, you know, and it's a huge mystery to suffer. And we suffer, our hearts get broken terribly. And all kinds of horrible things happen to us. And it's a huge mystery to feel that with great depth. And that's one of the opportunities available through mindfulness practice, is not necessarily to get a solution, but to experience our life with great depth. And experiencing the depth of our life, to stand in a kind of, I don't know what the right word is, in awe of how mysterious it is, even when there's difficulty. It kind of shifts the perspective of our problems. It doesn't necessarily get rid of them, but we understand that to be a human being and to live in society with all its complexities is a phenomenally mysterious thing. And then to be willing to live in the mystery of it, or the vulnerability of that mystery, is a movement towards freedom. So you might, as you sit and do your meditation practice, I'll say it this way. The attitudes we bring to our meditation practice are often a microcosm of the attitudes we bring to our life. And as we study how in our sitting practice we say no to things and reject things and we get to know those things really well, I think we start becoming more sensitive and wiser to the ways we do it in a grosser ways in our life also. And some people have this attitude of saying no to things much more than others, just different personality types. There's nothing wrong with it. But all of us, I think, do it to some degree. You know, rejection, denial, turning away from things, rather than listening deeply, rather than looking deeply, rather than sitting in the midst of it and being open to that experience. So there's various manifestations of this. So one of them is this experience right now is the wrong experience to be having. There's a right experience and there's a wrong experience. And what's happening now is the wrong one. In mindfulness practice, in Buddhist practice, whatever experience you're having is the experience you're having. It doesn't need to have any kind of label of right and wrong. Right and wrong doesn't belong as a label to what's happening right now. It's because it's happened. It's happened. It's happened, it's happened. Does that make sense? So I remember Anna Douglas, who's a Spirit Rock teacher, once saying something like this attitude some people have, it shouldn't be happening. And she's a very passionate woman, and she'd say, and how do you know it's not supposed to be happening? But how do you know it's supposed to be happening? Because it's happening. And now this isn't like condoning, you know, terrible things that are ongoingly happening. But in the moment, what's happening has already just happened. It's just happened. And why bother with any kind of label? It's what happened. Isn't that nice? So we have right and wrong, and then or it's not good enough, or then the other one is it's not enough. You know, we say kind of same thing. It's not enough. There's a if only mind. You know that if only mind. Mm-hmm. If only my knee didn't hurt so much when I meditated. If only I had a softer zafu. If only the room was quieter. If only I can get more concentrated. If only I hadn't eaten a huge dinner before coming here. If only, you know, you can fill in your own, if only. The statements, if only, are kind of a saying no to what's actually happening now. Saying, oh, if you're not saying, oh, this is okay, this is where I wake up, this is where I'm going to bring my deep consciousness to. You're rather saying, if only it was different, then it would be really right. So that's enough for me. So any comments or questions? Yeah.
The
my understanding of the third noble truth is that there's an end to suffering.
Yes.
And isn't that, it seems like that could be kind of a little misleading that, well, it should be ending, and I'm, you know, that's your goal, to get it to end. But what you're saying is that's maybe not right.
Not right, or is it not right? Right or wrong?
The wrong goal.
The wrong goal. The right goal. Let's see if I can reject something properly. I feel like whatever I'm going to say, well, I'll put my foot in my mouth. But let me say it this way: the goal of Buddhist practice is to be free of suffering. And my hope and aspiration for all of you is that all of us, including myself, is to be completely be free, totally free of suffering, to find, really discover the third noble truth and let it really bloom and blossom in our life to full degree, to experience that cessation of suffering that's being talked about. That's my heartfelt wish for all of you and for myself. However, in the moment-to-moment practice of mindfulness, the way that that's done is by not trying to do it. If you're striving after that goal, I mean, to kind of lean in that direction. So what do we say in the Buddhist tradition? You're not supposed to be striving for that goal. You're supposed to kind of softly lean into it. Incline yourself in that direction. So my description of my friend, my friend wasn't inclining himself to that goal. He was like latching on. And in latching on, he was actually getting further away. His contact with Buddhism, after the initial relief of suffering it brought him, actually brought him more suffering. It's so sad. The moment-to-moment doing of the practice, it's simply to be present fully for what's actually given to you in the moment, without any attempt to get anywhere by doing that. But in doing that, that itself is a kind of relief. Because much of our suffering in our life comes with trying to make it different. Resisting change, holding on to what's changing all the time, or wanting different what's not here yet, wanting something different, or rejecting what's here because we don't like it. There's always ways which we reject or want that's different than just simply being conscious of what's given to us in the moment. And the path of entering the fire, the path of entering consciously into the present moment, not wanting it to be any different, that is the path that also then leads to the cessation of suffering, if you can do it thoroughly. And that's the trick, to do it thoroughly. So that's kind of why I want to talk about this tendency we have to say no to things. Because it's very important, I think, to become conscious of the subtle and gross ways in which our mind works. And so I offer you for the theme for this week, for you all to study in your own minds your tendencies to say no to things, or to not deny things, to reject things, to turn away from things. And I'm not going to tell you to stop doing that exactly. But what I'd like to, what I'm very interested in is if you can become more conscious of that tendency. And the more conscious you become of any tendency like that you have, the freer you become of it. And what we're looking for is a life that's experienced deeply by being experienced consciously. And I think a deep conscious life is, even the one that suffers, makes the suffering quite, we can bear it gracefully. Yes?
Well, one of the things that happens with me a lot is that I get sleepy. And, I keep hearing how sloth and torpor are these great sinks and that you're wasting your practice. And so it's pretty hard not to want to not be sleepy when I'm practicing. And, I try to experience it and focus on it. And there are times when that works, but there are a lot of times when it does.
So sloth and torpor in the list of the hindrances is a little bit more specific than the way most Vipassana teachers talk about it. We often, in retreats, we include in that category sleepiness and tiredness. But technically, it doesn't include that. Sleep and tiredness, and some of us that have so-called sloth and torpor, we're just sleep-deprived. We're a culture that's sleep-deprived. So, maybe it's more important to get more sleep than to get more meditation. But sloth and torpor as one of the hindrances is actually a kind of volitional movement of the mind. It's a choice of the mind, in a sense. It's very somewhat unconscious. You might not see the choice, but it's a choice of the mind to move towards becoming sludge-like. It's a kind of movement of resistance. I call it, for me personally, the Sears mind. Because when I was 10 or 11 or 12, my mother would drag me to Sears to buy clothes for me. And this is one of the worst experiences that a human being could possibly endure. My God. What?
Kmart's worth.
You know, for a 10-year-old. Oh, my God, you know, and I would get so sleepy and tired and slothful, and I could barely pull my legs. Oh, I'm so tired. We have to be here. Oh, come on. And we'd leave Sears. Boom. Everything was fine. And there was a choice being made, you know, to resist. So when we try to bring... So in trying to bring mindfulness to sloth and torpor, the first thing we want to do, it's very helpful not to reject something, not to try to get rid of something, but rather to enter it fully as it is, take it as the given. Because if you do that, then you have a much better opportunity to understand what's going on deeply with it. But if you're constantly involved with criticizing it, judging yourself for having it, trying to overcome it by some kind of wonderful technique, you might actually be missing an opportunity to go deeply into the depths of your life to understand what's really going on there. So that's one of the reasons why I say over and over again, don't try to get rid of anything. Don't try to fix it, but rather try to go into it as deeply as you can. Accept it for what it is, and then study it, get to know it. So does that make sense? Now, of course, there are sometimes it can be useful to use techniques. And one of the techniques, you know, there's the whole Buddhism has closets and attics and of techniques and practices. You know, there's just like lots of things to do if you want to do things. And so depending on a particular condition, some teachers might actually say something. And like someone might look at you directly in the eye and say, you know, life is really short. We don't know when we're going to die. You better get on with it. Don't waste your time. And you might just feel the energy going up your spine and boom, you're energized. I don't know when I'm going to die. And I might die tonight. Wow. I better pay attention here. And just super energized. And with the energy, you bring a lot of attention and a lot of acceptance of the present moment as it is. And boom. It's great. So, but for that, you need to get yourself a teacher who has a lot of, real authority figure. There's a lot of charisma. A lot of stature. A strong voice. Can raise his eyebrow just right and penetrate right through you and lay it on the line. But, you know, you got me. So I just say, you know, pay attention. So one more maybe? Yes.
The story that you told about your friend in Nepal brought to mind a quote that relates to this whole subject. I don't know where it's from, but it goes like this. Anxiety emerges from craving for life to be other than it is.
Beautiful, thank you. That's a beautiful way of capping phrase, they call it in Zen. A summarizing phrase for the whole talk. So thank you. Let's say it again.
Anxiety emerges from craving for life to be other than it is.
May you all experience the wonderful depth and mystery of life as it is.